I'm going to get more out of this than you are. The reason I say that is not blind faith, but the quality of the information that was coming from you to Len, as well as from him to you last night. So I know that, there's one thing I know, and that's how little I know. I came here 19 years ago from Britain with my family. Told you that we were born in Wimbledon, both my wife and I. And London is a city that has 2,000 years of history. Colorado Springs has around 160 years of white history, considerably longer in the Indian sense. But I was starved of tradition and of history when I came here. And so starting maybe 6 or 7 years ago, I began to try and make the most of what local history there was. I thought, if it's a thin slice, I am going to try and become as knowledgeable as I can about that thin slice. And so I've been involved in studying the history of the Pikes Peak region in general, and then more specifically, the history of this estate. Now, we all know how skilled Len is and how knowledgeable he is in the Palmer era. So what I have tended to do is to concentrate either on what went on before Palmer or on what went on after Palmer. That's a sort of unwritten understanding between Len and me. Good morning, Len. Did you buy anything this morning? No. You've been to the auction? Oh, I see. Okay. So a lot of what I have to say, such as it is, will be concerned with the period 1909 to 1953, the death of Palmer to the beginning of the Navigator ownership of the property. In the handout here, there are a number of things, and I've used different colors so that I can quickly refer to them, but the pink outline, the basic first page that you should find here, gives the essential elements in the ownership of the Glen, starting with Palmer in 1971. I'll go back before that in a moment, but I just want to use this page for orientation. So we have 1871 to 1909, the Palmer era. Then 1909 to 1916 was a period of transition. One of the documents that I have laid out for you here is Palmer's last will and testament. And the fatal thing in his will, of course, as so often happens, quite understandably, is section 19. He says, "All the rest, all the remainder and residue of my estate, I give and bequeath unto my daughters equally." So it was almost inevitable that the estate had to be broken up and sold, because one third had to go to each daughter. And by 1911, 1912, two of the three daughters, as we know, were married. And so there was immediately a closing down of the estate and an attempt to pass it on to new ownership. I've called this a period of transition and ambitious schemes. Dorothy Palmer, who was then Dorothy Palmer Watt, in particular, was in the forefront of this. She came up with a land plat down the valley for something called Glen Eyrie City, which would have been a major development moving down towards what is now Pleasant Valley, and some other schemes too. But things settled down 1916, 1917 into an organization called the Glen Eyrie Companies. They were a syndicate of business investors from Oklahoma. The two principal people were Dunn and Eaton, and they got a long way into the process. They platted sites, and this is worth looking at. This is their plat for the current area of the Glen. And by the way, I don't know if this is something that you already knew, but we have 792 acres on the Glen itself. We have an additional 307 acres at Eagle Lake, total 1,099. Currently. The property ranged up to 11,000 acres at its maximum. I have left up here for you a 1925 plat of the property, of which the only part that now belongs to the Navigators is the part approximately that I'm circling. But it ranged right up, north, up the valley there. This is the Flying W Ranch here, which was known as Blair Athol. We'll talk about that. These are four other ranches. This is down to Pleasant Valley, and what is now called Rock Ledge Ranch is here, and then a lot of property was owned also up on the Mesa. In 1925, we're talking about 9.5, I think, to 10,000 acres. Anyway, the central area, back on the pink sheet here, in 1917, what the Glen Eyrie companies did is that they decided that they would turn this valley into 150 luxury villas. And this plat shows the actual sites, all numbered 1 to 150. So they got that far. It's worth getting the magnifying glass later and looking. These are the three Mesa reservoirs. The only one that has water in it, as you probably know at the moment, is Mesa number 3, which has more than double the capacity of number 1 and number 2. They always gave trouble. They leaked. We'll talk more about the reservoirs a little later. So here we have in 1917 a very ambitious scheme. There's an 18-hole golf course that runs down towards Pleasant Valley. There is one hole, I think it's hole number 9, where they actually started work. And if we had time, I'd take you down there and you'd see the beginnings of a green. I don't play golf, but I think the flat bit is called green. Yes, good. Okay, the beginnings of a flat bit, number 9. The certificate of incorporation to do this was granted in February 1917, and we have lots of plans. And you might be interested, I'll pass around to you some of the designs that they were offering for, I have to find these things, and I may fail. No, they're here. These are precious, the only copies I think we have. And a lot of these things behind me are originals and they should be more protected. Beautiful homes. There they are, all sorts of different designs to fill the valley. Another thing they were going to do in 1917 was to drill a road tunnel through Echo Rock. It's here on the plan. Another thing they were going to do was build a bridge over the canyon. That's the first of two times that people have wanted to build a bridge over the canyon. The second time was about 10 years ago when the original developer of Cedar Heights wanted to link himself up with the mountain, with the what is now the Mountain Shadows property, and wanted to build a bridge. Desecration, a tragedy it would have been. Let's see. The sale of lots started in 1918, but the syndicate in the closing years of the First World War very mercifully ran out of money. And so the only physical evidence of this whole scheme that can be found on the Glen now is down in the Central Valley. How many of you have walked down there beyond the sports green and found about so high off the ground the outline of a building? You know where that is. Okay. That was their sales office. It was probably a wooden structure, so Mr. Cochran, the next owner, could level it, but he never bothered to take out the bricks and the stones that formed the foundation. So that was the sales office of the Glen Eyrie companies. During that time, they had some ingenious marketing and merchandising ploys. In the carriage house, for example, they did a different thing at each of the two ends, and this actually happened. At one end, they had Elizabeth Martin's tea room. This was for the more genteel people. And a lot of people came. They charged entrance fees in 1916 and 1917, and they got up to 40,000 people a year coming to look at Glen Eyrie. So they were very serious about this. So we had Elizabeth Martin's tea room, and in my book of photographs here, near the back, you'll find a photograph of a couple of ladies sipping tea outside the carriage house there at the tea room. At the other end, the south end of the carriage house, was the Black Horse Tavern. This is something that would have caused General Palmer to turn in his grave, if he'd had a grave, because he was cremated. But that was for the alcoholic fraternity. And within quite recent years, when the navigators redid the inside of the carriage house, you could see the outline of the black horses painted on the wall and other aspects of the tavern there in our current carriage house. At the far end of the main carriage house, downstairs. Yes, yes, yes. Not the battery house, which is the squat building just beyond, but the carriage house. The tea room was up this end where we still have our dining room, in the carriage house. you know, I don't know what we call it. We change our names so often, but the dining area at this end downstairs. Yes. Was at the other end. Both on the ground floor, different ends. Yeah. They also had elaborate parties and banquets here in the Great Hall in that period. But I think the most intriguing thing they had, and it particularly, I think, will appeal to the ladies among us, was the Robin Hood Girls' Camp. Now, project yourself back into an age when we didn't have aerobics, but we had something called calisthenics. It was very important, especially for young ladies, to get plenty of fresh air and to jump up and down a lot. And so that was basically the purpose. They did croquet, they did archery. I will pass around this one, just take it out and pass it around. They had this uniform. There was a big feather in your hat. The girls had to wear a hat. Even when playing tennis or badminton, they had to keep their hat on. And it was a well-regimented little organization. I want to do a lot more research on it. I don't know if it was open to all women or just women who had fallen on hard times or whatever, but it was modeled on Robin Hood and Sherwood Forest. The relationship between the Glen Eyrie companies and the Robin Hood Girls' Camp is not yet clear to me. In any case, just going on with this summary, which I became a bit elaborate there, but going on with the summary, we fortunately find that the Glen in 1918 is put up for sale and is eventually sold for $450,000 to Alexander Cochrane. You might like to notice down the right-hand side of this pink page the sort of stability in the prices over so many years. Permit me a digression, another digression, because it relates to what was asked last night. Someone asked the value of the Palmer estate at the time of his death, and Len has provided that for me, and it was just over $3 million. I think it was $3,030,000. It's there, is it? Okay, there it is, $3,030,000. Now, I worked with the indices of inflation that the government puts out, and as of a couple of years ago, that would be $51 million. So maybe 52, 53. If you were asked, you could say that the estate at the time of his death was worth somewhat more than $50 million in our currency today. Okay, back to Alexander Cochrane. He was a fascinating man from Yonkers, New York. I've given some of the basic information. Len, you have some of my papers on Cochrane, don't you? I was looking for them last night. Sent them to you in March. I hope you'll nod. Well, we'll talk about that later. Okay, but you can see that he was a sailor. When war broke out in 1914, he had his own boat, so he sailed across the Atlantic and volunteered to become a British officer, and the British commissioned him. He didn't do much in the war. I think he just moved around in the Channel and in the coastal waters, but he had a rather advanced yacht called the Warrior. He was a carpet manufacturer, a philanthropist. He'd inherited basically the company from his father. Very prominent socialite, described as the most eligible bachelor on the East Coast for many years. He eventually fell to a woman by the name of Ganna Wolska. Ganna has an extraordinary history. She had six husbands, including very significant gentlemen, such as the McCormick, who is the Reaper man. You know McCormick Reapers? He was one of her husbands. And some socialites and a film star, whose name I forget. She outlived all of her six husbands and died about 10 years ago in Montecito, California, aged 100. From each husband, she picked up large sums of money in the divorce settlement, including Mr. Cochrane. So she was a very wealthy person indeed. She invested a lot of her money in a place called Lotus Land, which is out in Montecito. Have any of you been to Lotus Land or have heard of it? It's a tropical plant area, and that was her passion. She never came here, as I think Len mentioned, because he married her in 1920, It was a quiet thing in Paris, and he divorced her within 18 months because she was already living with her next husband. I think he was the third, and she was moving on towards the fourth in fairly rapid order. She found him dull. Carpets and Colorado was not quite her cup of tea. She wanted something more cosmopolitan. Mr. Cochrane seems to have turned more to the Glenery estate after his divorce, because the Pink House was built in the period 1924-25, so we can't say it was built for her. It was built after the divorce. But the one thing that he was concerned about at that time was getting plenty of sunshine. And of course, one of the defects of the buildings that Palmer, one of the very few defects, is that we're on the side of the valley that doesn't get that much sun. You look now, the sun is shining on the Pink House, but it's not really, or hardly probably, shining on the roof of this building. So he built his Pink House as a livable version of the castle that would give him the sunlight that he wanted in a manageable environment. The castle was basically locked up during this time, and he also extended the property to the north. As I mentioned, the Douglas, Lansing, and Fairley ranches up here, until he had 6,000 or 7,000 acres. And he tried to sell in 1927 because he was already dying. I think he had TB. I want to say a little about TB later. Had difficulty selling. But he did, as Len said, we have pictures of it, have a large auction in the Great Hall here in 1927 and sold almost all the fixtures and fittings that could be moved out. So that was a sad time for us. That's when we lost so much of the furniture. When he died in 1929, he left it to his nephew, Thomas Ewing, somewhat of an nonentity, a man who never came here as far as I know. But it was already, I think he must have foreseen that Ewing was not interested. He'd already, from 1925 onwards, placed the property in his holding company, which is called the Hillbright Corporation. So although I show the Hillbright Corporation from 1929 to 1938, as I say, it was formed in 1922 and it was dissolved in 1938 when Mr. Strake purchased the Glen. They were just a front. They were New York lawyers. They made desultory attempts to sell the property, but it was a period of increasing neglect. There were caretakers here, particularly the Burkhard family, B-U-R-G-H-A-R-D, whom I'd like to talk about later, but the estate was essentially closed. I have talked to a man who runs a print shop down there by King Super in Uinta Gardens, and he was a young man in the 1920s and 30s, and a couple of things they would do every Halloween. They would break into the castle and rush around in the dark enjoying themselves. What a wonderful thing in a totally pitch-black castle to do on Halloween. So a lot of damage was done then. The second thing was the chandeliers were still hanging, for example, in the music room, and the kids would break in and they'd take one of the crystals and so on, and they would give it to their young lady and so on. That's what I'm told anyway. So there was a certain amount of vandalism going on during that whole period. Then George Strake came along in 1938 and restored the estate to a living place. However, basically, he only came here in the summer. First of all, let me say a little bit about who he was, since he's important to us. He's the man who, under God, sold us the property. The real turning point of the Depression in Texas, and I'm reading from some printed material here, came with the discovery of oil at a place called Conroe, C-O-N-R-O-E, in December 1931, by a little-known wildcatter, George William Strake. So Strake became the discoverer and the owner of the most profitable Texas oil field, the Conroe Field. He opened up a strike, which basically was 50 miles wide and 500 miles long, running across much of Texas and Louisiana and Mississippi. Many other fields were found, but never another Conroe. This article was written in the 20th anniversary in 1951 of the strike. It says that George was a deeply religious man with a mystical quality. He was a staunch Roman Catholic, by the way. And his concept of Conroe was remarkable because he believes he was led by God to drill at that certain place. And he feels and has written that it was by divine guidance and assistance that he discovered the field. By 1952, his assets exceeded $50 million, and so on and so forth. He doesn't feel he owes his great wealth, but considers himself more a steward, so he would be very comfortable with our approach to the Glen. I had the privilege of going to Houston and spending a lot of time with his son and doing research in the building that the Strake family still have there, among the bank buildings. And Len has hosted various members of the Strake family a number of times, right? Why did they buy it, and why did they get rid of it? Mr. Strake purchased it because he was very much an outdoors man and because he had a bunch of young children, between 4 and 6 children, and he was looking for a summer place to get away from the heat of Texas, as so many others have subsequently done. For example, many of the Texans in the Garden of the Gods Club area, he wanted to come to Colorado for his summers. And he brought with him his own black servants. We have color movies, silent movies, but excellent quality, showing the Strake family and their servants and their guests in 1939 and 40. The movies essentially are centered around the Pink House and Eagle's Nest and Echo Rock Cottage, and there's also a picnic at Eagle Lake, and I have them all on video, and I'm going to show you 10 minutes of one of them later this morning. Particularly the flowers, because I want you to see what the rose arbor and the greenhouses look like, and just have faith that once again we could have flowers in this environment. Why did Mr. Strake sell? I think for several reasons. One, his children were growing up and marrying after the Second World War. Secondly, in 1947, there was a disastrous flood. One of the hazards of the Glen is the flash floods. And if you were to turn on here, you would find a yellow page called Precipitation. This is just a brief summary of the major floods that there have been in this area. 1885, 1921, the Pueblo flood, and 1935, the Memorial Day flood. But the one we're interested in is over the page, 10th of May, 1947. Strake's supervisor was living in the gatehouse at the time, Bob, and here's his graphic account. Around 7 p.m., without any warning, a flood of water came roaring down the canyon, caused by a cloudburst up on the mountains where the canyon heads. That's up at Eagle Lake. Resulting damage to the reservoir and spillway, the carrying down for 9 miles of rubble, trees, logs, boulders, gravel, and rubbish, which was strewn throughout that distance and throughout the lower valley lawns. The total loss, when fully determined, will be from $75,000 to $85,000. Well, that was a very low estimate, because if you look 3 paragraphs further down, the state engineer informed Strake that he'd be personally liable for any future break in the mountain dam, the Eagle Lake Dam. It hadn't been maintained. And the property, the whole of the property that Strake owned, now, mind you, he was only now owning about 1,000 acres. In 1944, he'd sold most of it. But anyway, was valued at $100,000 salvage, rather than close to $500,000. Len, again, has photographs showing the water coming up to within Len several feet of the Pink House. And we have photographs of the schoolhouse out there, drifted probably 10 to 20 yards down and was at a rakish angle hanging over the edge of the creek. We nearly lost it. I think 5 or 6 of the 7 bridges were totally taken out. It was devastating. So that was the major flood. We had another one in 1965 and a minor cloudburst in 1977. If I were a pessimist, I would say on the Lord of Averages, it's about time we had a major flood here. And now we've filled in and built the kitchen in the wrong place. Len talked about that. We're in more trouble than we might have been. But we also have better warning systems up the canyon. So the Hillbright, George Strake, he sold because his children were grown up. He sold because his property had been devastated. And lastly, he sold because he had real problems with caretakers. The families, I don't want to use their names because some of their descendants still live in the city here, but basically it was a question of not having good help when you only come in the summer for 2 or 3 months. And the place was not being well maintained. He wanted to sell it, as you know, to the Archdiocese of Denver, but they said this would be very nice for them, but would he please endow it so that they wouldn't have any upkeep costs. And he was rather affronted, apparently, by that, even though he was a Catholic. And so you know the story of how we had the opportunity to bid for it for this amazingly low price. So that's just a general overview of the ownership. I want to go way back into the period well before. First of all, any questions on that? Or anything you want to say? Anything you want to add? Disagree with? Yes? No. That's on my list of things to do research on. The whole period from Palmer's death until 1916, to me at least, is very obscure. There were three daughters involved, and the executor, Mr. Krause, George Krause, K-R-A-U-S-E, ran things with a heavy hand. We heard last night, for example, about Edmund Van Diest, who basically had built this castle for the general and was extremely trusted. Would you spend 2 years going around Europe with your family while this castle was being built and just trust the man who was in charge? So Edmund Van Diest was a great friend of the general's. One of the first things that the executor did, George Krause, is give a month's notice to Mr. Van Diest. And it was quite a shock. And I also, if I'm adequately, yeah, here we are. Florence Ordelheid. Florence Ordelheid was one of the most interesting of Palmer's servants. He was the one who was responsible, I believe, for taking the batteries around, wasn't he? Okay. I'm getting in a fit of multiple digression. I'd like to talk about batteries. I'd like to talk about several things. Let me just stay with 1909 to 1916. Okay. Florence Ordelheid, when he was interviewed, said, quote, "After the general died, Marjorie asked me to stay on as caretaker. The job sounded good, but in the long run, it wasn't so flowery. It was a lonely and a spooky place after everyone moved out and the help was discharged." So apparently pretty soon after his death, things were pretty much shut down. And then the Bass family, the Bass, what's his first name? Jesse Bass was the man whom General employed to take care of his wonderful horses. There's some marvelous horses. And after the death of the General in 1909, Jesse stayed on to take care of the horses until the Palmer girls decided what should be done. The cattle and horses were sold to the Douglas Ranch, that's up in the north, and Jesse was given the job of training horses for the Douglas people, and so on and so forth. And I do have somewhere here Edmund Van Diest's letter to the executor expressing polite incredulity that he would just be fired. So it was a difficult time, but George Krause was, I think, mainly working with Marjorie Palmer Watt to come up with these ambitious land platting schemes. Yes? His title? Executor. He was a New Yorker. Yes, he was the. There were several executors, but he was the only one who ever appears in the main documents. Yes. He continued on as an engineer, and in fact he wrote a report on the state of the water system and buildings on the Glen in the 1930s, which we have. But I am not sure, I have somewhere, but I can't remember how old he was when he died. Yeah. I do not know. Don't know. I'm going to jump right back to something that Len didn't touch. I said I'd do this at the beginning. I said I was concerned with the period before the general and after the general. You have a blue paper here, basic geology. You need to know that from a geological point of view, this little piece of 700 or 800 acres is absolutely fascinating. It's a wonderful place for geologists. How have I been able to write this paper? Because professors at UCCS beg to be allowed to walk around and look at the rocks. So I say, fine, you write a paper for me and I'll let you in at the gate. So it's been a good transaction for me. And that's happened in several areas with my study of the floods and so on, basically, people. Now, some of us probably would adhere to a recent 7-day creation, and that's fine, and others wouldn't, and that's fine too. I just want to tell you what geologists would say about this place. The second paragraph is a key one. If you were to sit, let's say you sit up at Dawson's Grave, and you look in this direction at the entrance to the canyon, you would see Pike's Peak granite. That's over 1,000 million years old. And you look in that direction at the mesa, and you would see rock which is approximately 77 million years old. It's more shale than rock, actually. So you have 1,000 million years of geologic time in the space of 1 mile, all of which is on our property. Fascinating. And I list down on the page, in order of when they were laid down, apparently, the dates of the various strata, 14 of them, I think. So I'm moving in the period from the oldest ones. Basically, you need to remember the oldest ones are up the canyon, the youngest ones are on the mesa, in terms of their time. Let's just look over the page, and I'll highlight a couple of paragraphs here. On page 2, about two-thirds of the way down, the fossils. There are a lot of fossils on the Glen, but you've got to be trained to recognize what you're looking at. Many of them can be seen at the entrance to the castle car park. If you walk to the car park, just on your left there, the rocks are going up at 23 degrees, and the compressed strata that we cut out when we cut in that car park, with the people who did the car park, there used to be a lovely pond there, Willow Pond, where our car park is. Many ponds on the Glen. You can see fossils there, just down about 3 or 4 foot high at the entrance to the car park. And let me just go over the page. The Rampart Range on page 3, the Rampart Fault, rather. I think we know this, you know this, but the major feature that sort of controls the layout here is the Rampart Range Fault. It happens to run past the Creamery, parallel with the Castle Moat, and past Bighorn Lodge. It's an inactive fault, but did you see in the paper that there was a 3-point-something earthquake south of the city about a few days ago? And there are more than 100 small earthquakes a year in the state of Colorado, so we shouldn't be too presumptuous. If there was a major one, the Rampart Fault would probably be one of the areas which would be the most disturbed. In very crude terms, my geology professor would be ashamed of me, but essentially what happens was that there was a large inland sea which ran from here across Kansas, halfway across America at a certain period. And it had sand, sandy beaches. That sea receded to the east, and the sand became sandstone. Sandstone is relatively soft. So you have from about here onwards for a long way, several miles deep down, but coming to the surface here, sandstone. Then I told you that the Pike's Peak granite is very hard, and it comes down almost to the end of the car park. and you have volcanic activity the other side of the Rocky Mountains. So you have very hard granite moving east and pushing into Glen Eyrie. And you have very soft sandstone. What happens? The sandstone is knocked straight up. So these sandstone rocks which march across the glen, what the Parsons family, Drake's friends, call the tongues of fire, are just the result of the Pikes Peak Massif moving a little bit to the east and just thumping them upright. And sometimes in the Garden of the Gods, more than upright. Okay? That's the most basic thing, and you can see that in the visitor center and so on. The sandstone, the red rocks themselves down the foot of page 3, the fountain formation, and then the Lyons sandstone, just by the International Office, that's Lyons, L-Y-O-N-S, named after a town further north in Colorado where particular formation was first identified. And that's what the sandstone that the rock pinnacles are made from. They're dunal, that is, they were sand dunes. And you can see the rippling of the wind, and it's interesting, it's explained here. And the Lyons formation is about 240 million years old, though the red rocks, Len. I don't know, it could be. I think it's more likely to be Lycans, which is the formation which is just next to that. It's a bit younger. If you look on the front page, you should see, yeah, Lycans formation, which is more in the valley floor. Okay, that's probably enough about the geology. I commend to you this simple paper. There's a much larger study I'm working with someone on. Oh, just a couple of other things to say. The center of the glen, the floor of the glen, is Morrison Formation. Morrison Formation is where you typically find dinosaur bones. In the last year, we have found some dinosaur teeth just on the edge of the property, on the north side. But we don't want to talk about that very much, certainly not as tour guides, because hundreds of people with little hammers will appear and start hammering away and annoying us. But just for your information, we're hoping to find some dinosaur remains in this area eventually. But we have some teeth. We also have a lot of shark's teeth down by Aspen Manor. Okay. First human habitation in this area that can be dated is 1300 BC. There are various scatters of rocks in the Garden of the Gods which have been identified and carbon dated over the last couple of years. I think you know, because you're well informed, that when the city wanted to build the new visitor center a couple of years ago, various branches of the Ute Indians appeared and said, "You're disturbing our burial places." Not a very sensible statement, because Utes don't bury people in the middle of fields. How do Utes deal with their dead? They put them in crannies of rocks and cliffs. So there probably are skeletons of Utes in some of these red rocks. But there certainly would not be any Utes buried where the visitor center was. The tribal historian of the Utes came up from Ignacio, and I invited him to have lunch here, and we're going to do that sometime. But he was very clear on their burial proceedings, practices. Anyway, Indians' sites exist in the Garden of the Gods from 1300 BC onwards. The oldest site identified here is what I call the Orchard Cave, just down beyond the maintenance shop. If you walk down there, you know what I mean by the maintenance shop. There is a saucer-shaped thing in the ground. That was one of Palmer's swimming pools, by the way, which the navigators cut into the edge of to build the maintenance shop. And on the far side of, let me draw it this way, this is south. This is the road going up. Here are the maintenance shops. Here's the horse barn or cow barn. And here's the fire road, okay? This was the Orchard Number 2 reservoir, which was a swimming pool. It had changing rooms here. It had a nice little island in the middle. and we have many photographs of people enjoying themselves there. If you were to walk around the edge of the maintenance shop and just keep up here, you come to the Lykins Rocks, L-Y-K-I-N-S. And here is a very shallow cave. I call it the Orchard Cave because of the Orchard Reservoir. There are what are called lithic scatters in there, L-I-T-H-I-C, stone scatters, which are definitely Indian. There's also the earliest human carving. I think it's 1881, carved in the back here, and then a lot of other people have added their dates later. By the way, one of the most interesting aspects of the Garden of the Gods is the human signatures, graffiti. The earliest one is the Mr. Kettering of 1731, white man who came through this part about 100 years earlier than most other white men and carved his name on what is called Signature Rock. If you're driving down the Gateway Road, okay, going that way, you have the North Gateway Rocks and the South Gateway Rocks. Just in front of the North Gateway Rocks, there's a rock which is about 15 feet high, quite close to what used to be the road, although they took it up last year. That's called Signature Rock. I've been agitating with others for it to be protected because it's got signatures from 1731 onwards, including many of the first gold party that came here in 1858. So that's a little bit on the geology and on the early Indians, pre-Palmer, as it were. Let's see, where should we go now? We might just take note of, obviously you've seen the chronological outline here. Len and I probably need to mesh our outlines. I have no license to be right, and there are probably things on here that we haven't got properly. But this outline brings us up to date in terms of what's been going on in the estate, particularly since Palmer. What I'd like to draw your attention to is this thing called buildings and structures. Several of the questions last night could be answered with reference to this green set of pages, buildings and structures. What I have tried to do is to identify in Section A all the current buildings that are still standing, and then in B, the buildings that have been moved. As a European, I am quite fascinated by the American propensity to move buildings. It's going on all the time in this city. You just pick them up and take them somewhere else. We can't do that over there because we build in brick and stone, but you build in wood, and therefore you can. And several of the buildings, as you know, that are now on the Glen have been brought from somewhere else. Echo Rock Cottage was originally John Blair's cabin, so I'm on page 7 now. It was originally up on the mesa, as Len told us. If you're driving out of the Glen, you look up on the mesa just a little bit to the right, and you see two or three green fir trees. They were like the yard, the garden of John Blair. That's where his cottage was. So the cottage came down from there to where it is now. There were also a couple of graves up there. They are not human graves. They are the graves of the dogs of Lyda Hill's sister. So several people have suggested erroneously that family members are buried there. They're not. Then the cottage, i.e. the cottage outside our gatehouse, was originally down on Bill Shoemaker's ranch, down near where Pleasant Valley is now, near the Valley Reservoir. And it was brought up in the 1930s for one of the Burkhard family to occupy. And the problem with a lot of our buildings is they keep getting different names. You've noticed I hesitate. I can't remember what names the navigators are giving our buildings now. And then the lodge garage was also moved. And then the demolished buildings. I think one of the main losses is this one at the bottom of page 7, the rustic lodge. You've probably seen photographs of it, haven't you? Yeah, it's one of you hasn't. It's basically the simplest way to express it is just below the eagle's nest. I think you said no, so that's the rustic lodge. It was still here when the navigators came, but it was being used, it was rather broken down and was kind of used as a chicken run, chicken coop. And then we had to demolish it. It was occupied by this Burkhardt family. Let me tell you a little bit about the Burkhardts. Do you mind me jumping around like this? Okay. In 1904, the great bell in the tower came from Germany. The bell was made, founded by Krupp, K-R-U-P-P, the armament manufacturer who was for many years responsible for a lot of Germany's military might. And I mention it as a German bell because on the very same day as the German bell arrived here, there arrived Billy Burkhardt, B-U-R-G-H-A-R-D. He came from Germany by way of Canada. He immigrated with his wife, Rosa. And he had worked on the way in New York as a seedsman and as a gardener. And he was hired by the general in 1904 as his gardener, put in charge of the greenhouses. Now, in 1904, it seems very likely that the greenhouses were down where the bungalow is now. We have maps that identify that. Why would they remove the greenhouses, American habit, from where the bungalow is and put them up to where you know they were until quite recently? That is against the gardener's cottage. They needed more sunlight. Most things on this side of the glen don't get enough sunlight. There's been a sort of tendency to move in that direction over the years. So Billy Burkhardt was put in charge of the greenhouses. He had three sons. George and Otto are still alive and are good friends of Len and me. And in fact, Otto has asked Len and me that his ashes be scattered on the site of his little house that you were just looking at, Terry. Which is now demolished, the rustic lodge. We'd like to honor that when the time comes, if the family permit. The Burkhardt family are very important, and one of the things I'm doing is trying to write the histories of families. The Burkhardt family, John Blair's family, the Strake family, and one or two other families, and therefore make the rather dry history come more alive by relating it to personalities. So let me tell you a little bit about what the Burkhardts did. They were one of the few people who were able to stay on after 1909 as continued employees, because it was abundantly clear, even to Mr. Krauss, that you couldn't just let all the acreage under cultivation, all the stuff in the greenhouses, just go to rot. And not only did they stay on and manage the greenhouses and maintain the lawns, and by the way, there were far more lawns than there are now. A lot of the history here is captured in the paper I've got in the package on the gardens of Glenelg, which is the history of the gardens. But the Burkhardts became outstanding in the production of competition flowers, particularly chrysanthemums, and so on. This cup is one of more than 50 awards that were won by the Glenelg greenhouses at major national and sometimes international competitions for chrysanthemums and other flowers. This particular one says, President's Prize awarded to the Glenelg greenhouses for the best 12 blooms, chrysanthemums, St. Louis, Missouri, November 1922, E.W. Burkhardt. There's a beautiful history. They founded a shop downtown called Burkhardt's Floral that many of you are aware of. The family no longer own it, of course. But they stayed on right through the 1930s. And even in the dark periods of the Hillbright Corporation, they did their best to look after the area, and they're fascinating people to talk to. Getting on a little, of course, but a lot of the information that I have on that period comes from George and Otto, the two brothers. That all launched off page 7 of the green sheet. So that's a little bit about the Burkhardt family. Let me talk about another family, or another man at least, John Blair. John Blair is known to you as General Palmer's landscape architect, but he was a lot more than that. In fact, he was the person who laid out Manitou Springs, platted it, designed it, and basically got it off the ground. John Blair came from Perthshire in Scotland. He lived in a place called Callander, which is very near a town that some of you will know in Scotland called Blair Athol, B-L-A-I-R, Athol, A-T-H-O-L-L. Basically, in that part of Scotland, the land was owned, and still largely is, by the Dukes of Athol. Their current castle is called Blair Castle. The Dukes of Athol live in Blair Castle. They, in fact, had the last private army in the British Isles. It was only disbanded a few years ago. It was an anachronism, but they were feudal landlords and on a major scale. So John Blair was born very close to Blair Athol, so it seems natural that when he comes over here as a Scotsman and he sees what was previously called North Glenerie, that is this lovely picnic area where the Flying W Ranch now is, that he and the general would agree to call it Blair Athol, and that's what they did. The only change they made was they use one L typically here. Don't know why, because it's two L's in Scotland. But John Blair, therefore, would probably be the person who gave his name to Blair Athol. Yes, the part with the red rocks there, the little shops lie at the foot of the red rocks. In fact, the development that Russ Wolf has done, although it's an estimable development, has really in the heart of what was that picnic area. So it's hard to imagine what it was like. And you know, a Victorian picnic was an elaborate thing. In a few minutes, I will read you a description of one of the general's picnics. Anyway, so John Blair, how did he get here? He came out to Illinois to do landscape gardening for various people, and he made the acquaintance of a certain Harry Austin in Oak Park, Illinois. And Austin had several children. He became a U.S. Senator, Senator Austin, and Austin and Blair became fast good friends. What would be the connection of Senator Austin with this city? Austin Bluffs. Yeah, that's right. Blair did landscaping work there for Mr. Austin. The Austin family became interested in sheep ranching. Therefore, they looked to Colorado. There was a lot of sheep ranching. It's mainly beef now, but there were a lot of sheep ranching in the last century in Colorado. And so in the early 1870s, Blair came out with Mr. Austin, or Senator Austin, to Colorado Springs to look around. Austin decided to buy his ranch there, Austin Bluffs now, and Blair met William Palmer. So both had a good trip. Palmer and Blair took to one another immediately, and Blair was hired. The first thing that Blair did in 1872 was to lay out with a Mr. Nettleton, as I've told you, what was called Soda Springs. It wasn't then called Manitou Springs, it was called Soda Springs, because that's what it was. And then later the name Manitou, and now finally the name Manitou Springs. And I'm looking here at the local newspaper out west for June the 20th, 1872. Mr. Blair, the landscape gardener, is engaged in laying out a small town close to the Soda Springs at Manitou. It will lie in a hollow on the left side of the road. About 150 lots are being laid, and another 75 for business purposes. Between 400 and 500 villa sites have also been laid out further up the valley, the location having been made with the utmost care to preserve the individual beauties. Realtors never change, do they? While contributing to the beauty of the whole scene, Mr. Blair will put on a large force to supplement the natural beauties of the Glen. Their Ute Pass was then called the Glen also. And they were putting up a new hotel in 1872. They'd ordered the furniture, and the hotel cost $45,000, would accommodate 100 desks, guests, and so on and so forth. A slight digression to tell you that by the middle of the 1880s, Manitou Springs was the premier watering place, the premier recuperation from illness place in the whole of the American West, equivalent to, say, Saratoga. Presidents came here. All sorts of people came to Manitou. This is before, essentially, the tuberculosis area. Let me just see the springs. By the early 1880s, Manitou had become the most popular summer resort in the West. It was called the Saratoga of the West. It was the first health resort ever established in Colorado. Ulysses Grant stayed there for a month in 1880 to take the waters. The hotel business boomed. The most important spring in early days was the Soda Spring. Palmer's company renamed it the Manitou Spring. They built a pavilion around it, as well as the Manitou Bathhouse, which is still there. Palmer and Blair and Dr. Bell, developed the first hotel, the Manitou House, in 1872, and so on and so forth. One of the big products was Manitou ginger wine, which came from the springs and was exported all over America. They made important distinctions. Some of the waters in the springs are a pleasant draught for drinking. Others should be used only as a medicine. They were said to cure kidney and liver disorders and alcoholism, and so on and so forth. I think you know that there's now a springs foundation, and that one by one these old springs are being refurbished, renovated, and restored. And I think that's just great. That's a little bit about Manitou Springs. I can't say that. No, I don't know that. And even if it was, it would basically be European money. I found a reference. There was a question about that. You know, I talked, Len talked last night about the money that was coming from Europe. For Palmer's developments in general, the quotation I saw this morning, this would be in the 1880s, 60% of the money came from the Netherlands, 30% came from Britain, and 10% from America. But 90% European money. At that period. Very strong. Now, you know, this place was called Little London. You're aware of all of that. Okay. I don't know. I haven't looked at the which hotels are still standing. I'm not sure. Yeah. Okay. Let me link something here that Len didn't talk about, talking about the Indians, the Ute Indians, and one of the things that Elsie Palmer saw the Utes doing in the Glen. But I'll tell you a couple of other things about the Utes which are interesting. One way of analyzing this region is that it is a transition zone. For example, I've already told you that there's a transition zone with 1,000 million years of geological history crammed together in the space of 1 mile. It's also a transition zone going north to south for vegetation. There are 5 different zones of vegetation within our 700 acres here. And we have a master's thesis on the vegetation of the Glen over here, which I will just pick up and identify for you. The Ecology and Vegetation of Glen Eyrie. Well worth looking at, done by a young lady. Again, the same principle. She wants to do a master's. I keep the key of the reception center, and I say, you can come on if you'll give me your thesis. It works so well for us. So Carla Bork is her name. She did this in 1992, and it's an excellent study of the life zone, the vegetation zone. So another transition. Then this was also a transitional area where the mountain weather system meets the plains weather system, state an obvious thing. It was a transition system also for a transition zone, also for sheep and cattle farming, and in a number of other ways too. But the one that I want to mention now is a transition between the mountain Indians, namely the Utes, and the plains Indians, namely the Cheyenne and Arapaho. In the 18th century, the Utes were the lords of the mountains, but there was trouble in store because the Arapaho, who basically, first time they show up on the radar screen were in Minnesota, They're all the time. They're moving southwest from Minnesota for many years, and then they have an alliance with the Cheyennes, and they begin moving onto the plains of Colorado, pushing out the Comanche and the Kiowa. And by 1810, we have the Cheyenne and Arapaho on the plains, and we have the Utes in the mountains coming down Ute Pass seasonally. Okay? Now, the Utes were nomads, and they moved up and down and around in the mountains. They're a very brave tribe, apparently. One of the enemy tribes was quoted as saying that the Ute Indian was harder to kill than any other Indian. They generally camped on hills within walking distance of a spring. Glen Eyrie was one of their sites, as we know. The Utes lived in teepees. We also know that. What we may not know is that all the work was done by the women. The women made the teepees, and the women erected the teepees, and the women took them down and moved them from camp to camp. In certain places on Ute Pass, there are still now, what is it called, the lodgepole tracks where the teepee poles were dragged by their horses as they went up and down Ute Pass. They always followed the same way. You can still see those evidences there. Horses were considered the property of the Ute women, and they were used for dragging things around. Here's a description of Ute Indians setting up camp in the Garden of the Gods in 1913. This was long after they'd been put on a reservation, by the way, but they were given permission to come back because the white men wanted to gawk at them and kind of enjoy the traditional ceremonial. They were led by Buckskin, you know, Buckskin Joe, Chief Buckskin, and he selected. His job as chief was to walk around the Garden of the Gods. He chose a site for his teepee. Once his was identified, then we knew where all the other lesser teepees could go. So here's the description by an observer. The men then scattered in every direction, climbing around in the garden on the big rocks and enjoying the scenery. The squaws proceeded to make camp. Old women and young girls dragged the heavy poles and rolls of canvas to the site selected for their teepee and then erected them. And then it says a bit further on, just a little bit more, Chase Mellon, brother of General Palmer's wife Queen, recalls the Indians leaving their annual summer camp near Glen Eyrie. The ponies were loaded with the squaws and the camp equipment, flanked by the lodge poles trailing on the ground with baskets strapped between them, holding the papooses. When moving camp for a serious purpose, the old and the decrepit were left behind to die. And if they died, they were put in the rocks, as I've told you. The Utes often wintered in the Garden of the Gods, and sometimes also here. The Ute Pass Trail is one of the oldest documented routes of any American, any Indian tribe. But here's what I want to quote from Elsie Palmer's diary. She describes the way that the Utes were hunting and she was watching them near the glen. Quote, "We saw a small flock of antelope running along the top of the rocks and a number of Utes clambering up with incredible speed in pursuit. One of the braves caught an antelope by the hind leg." Unquote. Can you believe that? Amazing. Amazing. They must have had some special resilience in their muscular structure. Something must have happened. I had an uncle who was a sprinter. He broke his leg. It was reset. He then took the Oxford University record for sprinting. It was a lot better after he was damaged than before. So these things are interesting sometimes. Okay, that's enough on the Utes. We're not trying to talk about the whole area. We're trying to talk about Glen Eyrie, so we'll drop that. Very good, as I understand it, very positive. The general, of course, from the time of the Civil War, and I imagine onwards, was a person who made, he didn't have any racial favorites, let me put it that way. The first black person recorded in El Paso County was a person whom the general brought here to do surveying with him in about 1869. I don't know if it's old George. Okay. Yeah. All right. That could be. Like Len, I've got more stuff than I can remember that I've got, and I'm sorry, but that could well be. By the way, a couple what I've got over here that you could pick up later, the chronological outline that's enough for everybody of the region of Colorado Springs as a whole, down like the Glen Eyrie one, bibliography of books about the Pikes Peak region, the original design by the General of Colorado Springs, very traditional up and down rectangular American design with the North Park and the South Park, Acacia Park and the other one. And on the back of it, a map that shows the extent of the 1898 fire that burnt down the Antlers. If you're interested in that, that was mentioned last night. There were questions last night about the Rio Grande Railroad. This man worked for many years on the railroad and wrote more than 30 books, many of them fictional, about the railroad. But the interesting thing for some of you who wanted to know, this is the map of the Denver and Rio Grande system and the Denver and Rio Grande Western system. So you can sort out the relationship between them, and you can identify the picture in the hallway that Len was talking about just near Mount Ouray, which of course was called after Chief Ouray, the revered chief of the Ute Indians, who was the chief negotiator for the Utes in Washington, and whose wife was Chipeta. Chipeta was beloved by white and Indian alike. She died, I think, as late as the 1920s, and more than 5,000 people, many of them white, went to her funeral. A woman of immense character. I also have over here General Palmer's own reminiscences, his words, of what it was like, what he was doing when he launched the city, and a description on one page, again, by the general, of why he started his railroad. And, so that's there. Now, I said that I would, I'm going to break in a moment, but I just want to read one other thing, and this has to do with Victorian picnicking and so forth. This is an account from a Mr. Garland who visited Glen Eyrie about 1900 with his family. This is from a book called Daughter of the Middle Border. And I want to read a few extracts. So they're the general's guests, okay? 1900. The castle hasn't been built, but the big number two house is standing here. We were due at a garden party in Glen Eyrie, General Palmer's palatial home in the foothills, and we obtained permission to bring our friends with us. The drive across the mesa was like a journey into some far country, a passage to a land which was neither America nor England, neither east nor west. It's an interesting description of how people felt about Glen Eyrie. Americans felt it was very European. Europeans like Queen felt it was dreadfully primitive and American. And so you have this sort of tension going on in some of the accounts. We entered the mouth of the narrow wooded canyon and drove for nearly a mile through a most beautiful garden in which all the native shrubs and wildflowers had been assembled and planted with exquisite art. We'll look at some of them on the video later. In 1900, by the way, most of the trees were deciduous, very few fir trees. Now the fir trees have crowded out the other types of trees, but when you see in many of the photographs that Len has and that I have in the booklets here, that the Glen presented a very different picture, because there was many more types of trees. In the study that we have on the vegetation, we've identified 90 types of trees that are still growing on the Glen. And this is a multiple digression, I know. I'm just rambling. But if you walk down there and you go across the road, the other side of the road, and you're on a sort of area that has a little slope on it, that area was a tennis court. Just the other side of that tennis court, there's an old tree at an angle. That's an apple tree planted by Mr. Blair for the general, and it's still fruiting. There were two of them, but a nameless navigator whose responsibility it was to cut down bad old trees cut one down a couple of years ago. So there's only one now. I feel like putting a little rim around it. Anyway, so here he is arriving at the glen. People were streaming in over the mountain roads, some on horseback, some on bicycles, some in glittering, gaily painted carriages. When we reached the lawn before the great stone mansion, we found a very curious and interesting throng of guests, and in the midst of them the general, tall, soldierly, clothed in immaculate linen, and wearing a broad white Western hat, receiving his friends, assisted by his three pretty young daughters. The house was a veritable chateau, the gardens a wonderland of Colorado plants and flowers, skillfully disposed among the native hedges and scattered along the bases of the cliffs. The towers of gray stone were English, it's the towers of the building, but the plants and blooms were native to the Rampart Hills. In a very real fashion, Glen Eyrie bodied the secular and powerful character of its owner, who was at once an English squire, a Pennsylvania Civil War veteran, and a Western Railway engineer. And then he says, 2 days later, at the general's invitation, we joined his party in a trip over the short line railway to Cripple Creek. We traveled in his private car, that's the one called Nomad, N-O-M-A-D, and the luxury of this novel experience made my wife's eyes shine with girlish delight. She said, I don't know where all this glory is going to land us, unquote. After this Aladdin's lamp luxury and leisure, how can I get back into washing dishes and canning fruit? So that was, the wife was a bit unsettled by the glory. And then it happened that, Palmer then, he was a rare man for hospitality, invited them to travel with him down to Fort Garland, where he owned an enormous quantity of land down south of here. And they call Fort Garland a mysterious little town in southern Colorado. In fact, it's the earliest European foundation in Colorado, Fort Garland. And the general was encamped there. We were met at the station by one of the general's retainers. We found ourselves in a mountain wagon on our way towards etc., etc. Mexican huts lined the way. The land grant had been at one time a part of Old Mexico. It contains nearly 700,000 acres and is the property of General Palmer. So most of Edmund Van Diest's time was spent south of here looking after other parts of the general's empire. Let's see. I'm looking for this champagne thing that I mentioned last night. Here we are. In a lovely grove on the bank of a glorious stream, we found the lord of this demesne, that's the general, and his three daughters encamped, surrounded by a platoon of cooks, valets, maids, and butlers, a camp which highly amused us because of its luxury. Now, this is the kind of toughing it that I believe in, declared my friend. It is suited to elderly old people such as myself. Our luncheon, which contained five courses, came on with the plenitude and precision of a meal at Glen Eyrie. The rusticity of the function was altogether confined to the benches on which we sat and the tables on which we ate. The buffeting or the buffeting or the butlering was for the most part urban. And then they'd forgotten something. So the general says, take my rail car back to Colorado Springs and, you know, you can get there and back in a day. And so the lady, Mrs. Ehrlich, or Mrs. Garland, goes back in the rail car just by herself to pick something up. And then it ends up, the general was a soldier even in his recreation. Each day's program when camping and picnicking was laid out in orders issued in due form by the head of the expedition. These arrangements held. No one thought of changing them. Our duty was to obey and to enjoy. That was nice. And there's a lot more of it. Len gave me that. Len gives me everything. Okay, we should stop, I think. And we were going to have a break, weren't we, around about now? And do look at all these things here. A lot of these papers are original. Please treat them with delicacy. Let me tell you just what this is before I go. This is an 1890s battery. There were batteries all over the glen. This particular one was taken from the top of the the gates. You've seen pictures of the gates where it went across. In there was an electric motor. We have the drawings for the electric motor done by a New York company. Palmer put his motor in 1904. We thought that Bob Sheffield had had a bright idea to electrify the gates. Palmer thought of it 90 years ago. The starter motor was run by half a dozen of these batteries, and then it was linked into the main motor, which drove the gates. And you can still see the poles at the side of the gates, which controlled them, worked beautifully. So this is the Columbia Dry Cell No. 8 battery, 1893. It could well explode. I don't know much about batteries.